Hello and good day, and welcome to this episode of Blood Club, where you're supposed to talk about Blood Club. And on today's edition, I have the great pleasure of welcoming Dr. Neha Mehta-Shah from Washington University. And she's going to talk to us today about one of the, I think it's the most difficult lymphoma, not only to diagnose, but often to manage, and that's peripheral T-cell lymphoma. We're going to steer away from talking about cutaneous T-cell lymphoma or mycosis fungoides and really stick to our mature kind of nodal, and maybe we'll venture into some non-nodal subtypes here. But welcome, Dr. Mehta-Shah, to Blood Club.
Thank you so much for having me, Matt. It's always fun to talk to people that are your friends about things that you like to talk about.
I want to kind of think about peripheral T-cell lymphoma and how the diagnosis is made. Because I kind of joke to some colleagues that I know it's a T-cell lymphoma when it's taken my hematopathologist over a week to come up with a diagnosis. How have you kind of seen that in your practice? And you know, just how confident are you when you get a diagnosis of T-cell lymphoma?
I think it's really challenging for like patients and providers, especially providers who don't have access to lymphoma, you know, specialist hematopathologists. But we know from studies that have been done in the community comparing to academic medical centers that the diagnosis of the subtype of T-cell lymphoma differs in up to 25% of patient samples when compared to academic centers, which means that there's just, you know, it's hard to make the diagnosis. You know, many times patients come in like having a biopsy that shows some atypical lymphoid infiltrate. They really can't tell if it's even lymphoma. Some of these patients have history of autoimmune diseases, and differentiating reactive populations from lymphoma can be especially challenging. I think there's some subtypes that are clinical pearls to always keep in mind. One is that peripheral T-cell lymphoma, the term reflects a number of different diseases, as you know, Matt. Peripheral T-cell lymphoma not otherwise specified, which then includes even further subtypes to look for cell of origin now. And then the angioimmunoblastic subtype, the cell of origin for angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma is the T follicular helper cell. And that disease is really driven by that cell. And now we know that there's two other diseases that we call different things that are all related to angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma called follicular T-cell lymphoma and then peripheral T-cell lymphoma of T follicular helper phenotype, which to us, I think in treating patients are really all treated very, very similarly in terms of their biology. And then there's anaplastic large cell lymphoma that gets divided into those that express the ALK proteins and those that don't express the ALK protein. Anaplastic large cell lymphoma universally expresses CD30. They tend to have these very large atypical cells. They usually efface the lymph node architecture completely. And so I think that disease is not so hard. When I see a community pathologist who's made that diagnosis, I usually tell the patients it's pretty unlikely that we're really going to change the diagnosis significantly. But in the other subtypes, it's sometimes the malignant cell is only a fraction of the population. There's a lot of other cells of the microenvironment involved with the tumor. There's confusion about whether the lymphoma originated from the B cells or the T cells, because you see atypical B cell populations sometimes concurrently in these lymphomas. So it's super challenging, you know, to make these diagnoses. I think the flow cytometry is critical to understand which markers are co-expressed on certain cells, specifically looking for T follicular helper markers, including PD-1 and ICOS and CXCL13, which aren't always done. I would say I think more increasingly being adopted, but not always done. And then a lot of times we rely on the gene rearrangements, you know, for these patients. So, you know, each T cell should have a specific barcode for the T cell receptor. And nowadays, you can sequence the T-cell receptor. So you can send off for clonality to see if the cells all carry the same T-cell receptor by next-generation sequencing techniques, which are pretty sensitive, sometimes very sensitive. And if you see a clonal pattern amongst the T-cells using TCR, then that sometimes is the clincher in making the diagnosis. Sometimes it depends on how often that's run at your institution. For us, even at WashU, we send it off and we tell patients to expect that it will be a week to 2 weeks to get it back because it gets run not every day. And then it requires a little bit of additional analysis from the molecular pathologist.
Right. So you alluded to all of these tests require a lot of tissue. And so I think that, you know, a lot of times we see cores getting done these days And often it can lead to some delay in the diagnosis because the tissue is often exhausted from the cores. And so incisional or excisional, if safe, biopsies, especially if you get that atypical T-cell lymphoproliferation kind of on a path report, I think can be, as you alluded to, incredibly important. Before we jump into the therapeutic aspect of peripheral T-cell lymphoma, you did a great job of explaining that we're starting to get to some subtypes of peripheral T-cell lymphoma NOS. We know that AITL, I think, arguably is becoming probably the most common peripheral T-cell lymphoma subtype as we kind of carve away the NOS at the fringes and start to redistribute that disease. But as we think about ALK-negative ALCLs, we're seeing maybe some targeted induction regimens using things like brentuximab vedotin. Are you testing for DUS22 or TP63 in that population of ALK-negative ALCL? And if you are, how is that informing kind of what you would consider doing in an induction or consolidation approach?
In ALK-negative ALCL specifically, there's been a couple of major papers looking at the importance of P63 and DUS22. And what the initial papers had shown was that DUS22 rearrangements or abnormalities are associated with better prognosis. And so if you had a DUS22 mutated anaplastic large cell lymphoma, the prognosis of those patients was better than the patients who didn't have that. And in peripheral T-cell lymphomas, we sometimes consider doing an auto transplant in first remission for those who are chemo responsive, but those who have ALK positive anaplastic large cell lymphoma usually are pretty chemo responsive even without an auto. And so we don't usually routinely do an auto. And there were some studies that were done predominantly from the group at Mayo showing that if you have DUS22 rearranged ALK negative ALCL, those patients did as well as the ALK positive ALCL patient, even without an auto transplant. So I think in that situation, we send it. And then P63 abnormalities have been associated with a poor prognosis in that population. And so I think it's helpful, super helpful prognostically. And sometimes when patients are on the fence about transplant and no transplant and what to do, that's, I think, the situation where we've used that data most confidently. As you know, Matt, you know, there have been a couple of other series now showing that at least the DUS22 doesn't seem to be quite as prognostic as that initial series showed. And so it's led me not to rely on that as heavily.
Are you using the IPI score to help inform you or just the biology?
We've been just honestly watching how well people do on chemotherapy, right? So the practical decision with the patient is, you know, after you finish chemotherapy, if you're in a complete remission, should you get a transplant or not get a transplant? If you weren't in remission, then the answer is moot. You know, more chemotherapy and stem cell rescue with an auto transplant isn't going to help you. So we don't do it there. If you're in a complete remission, but you really struggle through your chemotherapy and you were in getting infection after infection, or you ended up with other complications, then we think pretty carefully about not doing the transplant because those patients may have major morbidity or even mortality from a transplant. But if they sailed through and they're doing well, the discussion is, well, the sub-analysis from Echelon 2, which was a study that led to the approval of brentuximab CHP, had in that subgroup analysis, which was underpowered and et cetera, still showed there was a benefit to getting an auto transplant for those who were in complete remission. The DUS22 and P63 analyses from that study have not been reported. And so thus far, that's essentially what I've told patients, that if you were doing well and you tolerated chemotherapy well, the evidence seems to suggest doing additional chemo and stem cell rescue for ALK-negative ALCL may be of help.
As you were alluding to, I think if you think about Echelon 2, you know, it was a slam dunk from a free throw line for ALK-negative ALCL, but I think a lot of us are still kind of scratching our heads. I always find ourselves very interesting on how we use forest plots. You know, between how we've used forest plots for Echelon 1 versus Echelon 2, I know different diseases, you know, you really can kind of go, well, maybe in this one I would use it. And then this one is like, oh, you're supposed to use forest plots the way statisticians tell you to use forest plots. So outside of ALK-negative ALCL and ALK-positive ALCL, how are you utilizing BV-CHIP in, let's say, AITL or PTCL-NOS? Understanding that there's some very attractive, you know, upfront clinical trials that we'll spend a little bit of time talking about.
My analysis of the data is that for patients who don't have ALCL, there's probably not that much advantage of giving brentuximab. If you look at the curves for patients with AITL on who are on echelon two, the CHOP arm actually looked better than brentuximab CHP. And we know, you know, from other experiences across many lymphomas, not just T-cell lymphoma, that sometimes adding X to Y leads to toxicity that prevents you from getting like the backbone chemotherapy. And so I think that's probably some of it. You know, brentuximab CHP is a little harder than CHOP, I think, for most patients. And so I don't give it outside of that. The other part is that on echelon two, the patients all had to have CD30 expression in greater than 10% of the cells. The truth is, I don't know about you, Matt, but I feel like I see that very rarely outside of anaplastic large cell lymphoma. Like there are occasionally patients who have CD30 expression 20-30%, but it's like few and far between when they don't have anaplastic large cell lymphoma. And so most of the patients we see with PTCL NOS or AITL wouldn't have qualified, you know, for echelon two based on the inclusion criteria.
Yeah, I'm still very confused by the fact that I've always thought that brentuximab vedotin compared to vincristine, it would have been a better, you know, drug in T-cell lymphoma, but it just, even, you know, in the single agent BV study in relapse refractory PTCL, it was just so all across the board on who would actually respond regardless of CD30 expression from that standpoint. And I've always kind of struggled with trials. CHOP has always done better than you would have expected it to do, you know, and when you should pull out BV chip and when you shouldn't in that regard. But I want to transition now towards kind of some of the novel agents that we're bringing into the front line, you know, whether or not it's in your trial, the Alliance trial, you know, which is looking at a 3-arm randomized trial of what, duvelisib, CHOP, CHOEP versus kind of oral azacitidine, CHOP or CHOEP, and then kind of the base still being CHOP or CHOEP. And that's really an age-based, right, on who's getting CHOP, who gets CHOEP. And maybe you can lean into kind of how duvelisib and how oral azacitidine kind of work their way into the frontline setting.
Yeah, so I think, you know, so duvelisib is an oral PI3 kinase inhibitor. It was initially approved in CLL and then in follicular lymphoma, currently still available for CLL. In the initial studies of duvelisib across heme malignancies, they had seen that the response rate in peripheral T-cell lymphoma was about 50%. That was unexpected. It was under 20 patients. But that led to more excitement about duvelisib, leading to the development of duvelisib in combination with other drugs like romidepsin, but then also the evaluation of duvelisib as a single agent. So there is a registration study called PRIMO, the international study, phase 2 study of duvelisib. Ultimately, the dose given was 75 milligrams BID for the first 2 cycles. And then if you were responding, you dropped to 25 milligrams BID, which is the dose for CLL. That again showed the response rates about 50%, about 30% of patients achieve a complete remission, which is better than a lot of the drugs we have. Most of the drugs that had been approved or have been approved for peripheral T-cell lymphoma in the relapsed refractory setting have response rates in 25 to 30% of patients. So 50% is like a really big number to us. And the dynamics of response were relatively rapid. Interestingly, on the duvelisib romidepsin study, there was an option for patients to get duvelisib as a single agent for a cycle and then get a scan. And about 25% of patients were in complete remission within 1 month of treatment. So like to us, that's like the same dynamics of chemotherapy. So if you want to get people who are unwell better faster, like this was an agent that you could use. The registration study has been completed. It's been reported, you know, hopefully soon will be published. Eventually, we hope that it's approved, you know, for relapsed refractory peripheral T-cell lymphomas. But when you have agents that are that active, that work differently from the chemo that you're used to giving, the next question is, well, if we give it to people from the beginning, could you potentially kill the cancer early on with its drugs that work totally differently from the chemo and kill the clones that are going to lead to your relapse from the beginning? And so that led to the incorporation of duvelisib in the U.S. intergroup study of looking at duvelisib with either CHOP or CHOEP. Finding azacitidine was studied in like a case series, essentially, of 12 patients where they saw that the response rate in AITL was 75%, so 9 of 12 patients. But it was super exciting. And then that led to other studies looking at azacitidine and newer versions of azacitidine, like oral azacitidine. It looks like there that the response rate overall for azacitidine alone is a little less than what was initially shown in a large prospective randomized study. in the relapse refractory setting, but also had led people to study the use of azacitidine as almost this like priming agent for chemotherapy. So that's now been studied in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma in a study that was published by Peter Martin, looking at azacitidine, getting azacitidine for 2 weeks before you get your CHOP in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. It's been built into a elderly diffuse large B-cell lymphoma study led by SWOG and by Liz Brehm, also looking at that in the elderly population in a randomized fashion. And then Gia Ruan at Cornell had looked at that in T-cell lymphomas in a phase 2 study, showing that the addition of azacitidine to CHOP resulted in an overall response rate of over 84% and a complete remission rate of 75%. And so that seemed really promising and did not add any toxicity. So we had incorporated oral azacitidine with CHOP as another arm on this study. And one of the things we're really interested in this study is, do those who have T follicular helper phenotype lymphoma like AITL, do they fare better with these novel agents? Because the studies of these novel agents have all shown that that's the histology that seems to derive the most benefit. And does that pan out in a randomized study?
Yeah, this is definitely, you know, an exciting time. I know that we've really struggled in the relapse refractory peripheral T-cell lymphoma environment with, you know, certain drugs being pulled from the market or other ones coming up again for ODAC review. And so T-cell lymphoma really needs a win. And I hope we as an oncology community treating lymphomas can learn the lesson from SWOG 1826, which was, again, the frontline Hodgkin's trial, which was exciting to see that data reported. But I was even more excited that the lymphoma community and the, you know, those who were putting patients on that trial really did it as a group effort. And we got a large trial done in a very quick amount of time. And I think that we can do that here with the intergroup trial. If we all band together, that the U.S. can really rapidly accrue, you know, this randomized trial, which would be incredibly informative and helpful potentially to our patients who obviously in T-cell lymphoma need a significant amount of help. And I think, as we know, in large cell lymphoma, the best time to cure a lymphoma is when?
At the start,
absolutely. And so with that, we will end this edition of the Blood Club. I want to thank you again, Neha, for talking to us today through upfront peripheral T-cell lymphoma and what's kind of cool and novel coming your way into a clinical trial, your clinic towards you. Have a great day.